PNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
The heart is a blue. Today on the Positively Healthy Show, Maria won't be here, but we'll be listening to a transcript with Dr. Brian Hooker, and we'll be listening to Autism One. Autism One is a nonprofit, parent-driven organization that provides education and support to children and families touched by autism. So we're going to go ahead and listen to that now.
Brian?
Okay, well, it's really an honor to be guest host, especially with Representative Posey. Representative Posey has an illustrious political career. He's serving his third term as U.S. Congressman representing Florida's Space Coast and Treasure Coast. He previously served in the Florida State Legislature as Senator for 8 years and as State Representative also for 8 years. And he's worked at the Kennedy Space Center during the Apollo program and then started a successful real estate business, Posey and Company Realtors. He's a no-nonsense person, and I can confirm this directly, and he has been a leading voice for government accountability, both in the state of Florida, where he passed model legislation for holding government agencies accountable for how they spend tax dollars. And he's also been a leading advocate for transparency in government and holding federal government officials accountable for their actions. Representative Posey currently serves on the Financial Services Committee and on the Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. And Representative Posey has been a super friend to the autism community. He made a special effort to participate in the Congressional Oversight and Government Reform Autism hearing in November 2012, and he made an appearance, specifically because he is interested in this issue, and he's not even a part of the committee. He was elected as an ad hoc member of the committee for that particular hearing, and subsequently then he was a guest at the 2013 Autism One conference in May of 2013 in Chicago, Illinois. He has introduced bipartisan legislation along with Representative Carolyn Maloney from New York, and regarding autism, and he has been instrumental, along with a former Congressman Dan Burton, in the release of many background documents from the CDC regarding the link between vaccines and autism. Representative Posey has been labeled Mr. Accountability by a leading national journalist. He's been about accountability since his first days in the Florida State Legislature, and he continues in that the U.S. Congress. He is from the Sunshine State, and he's working to shine some of that sunshine on the dark corners of the federal government, and he believes that the CDC should not be exempt and is working to hold the CDC accountable in the area of vaccine safety. He said that our children are the most vulnerable and the most precious resource in our nation, and their safety should be paramount. So welcome, Representative Posey. We are so glad to have you.
Well, thank you, Ryan. I'm glad to be with you.
Well, obviously we're talking about autism, and there are many children with autism in the United States. The CDC just recently came out with their numbers saying that one in 68 children has autism directly, not just autism spectrum disorder, but autism. Now, I wanted to ask you, with this statistic, this is extremely alarming, but just to back up, how did you become familiar with the autism issue, and what are some of your concerns regarding the current autism epidemic, as well as issues that families with autism or with autistic children face?
Well, my interest in the issue goes back even to my days in the Florida legislature. I got to know Dr. Gary Kompothiaris and some of my other friends and acquaintances have been affected by autism. And quite frankly, I was always perplexed about having mercury in vaccinations. I mean, just from a common sense perspective, I thought that's that's kind of crazy. I mean, you know, we had to ban mercurochrome and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. And just by providence, one of the biggest advocates in Congress on the issue happened to be my predecessor, Dr. David Weldon, and I didn't even know that. And so when I came to Congress, I kept his staff. I'd been familiar with his staff, knew they did a good job, and we were on the same page, same chapter, same verse on this issue. So it was just kind of natural to move forward with it. You know, the 1 in 68 statistic you mentioned, that shows the magnitude of the problem. It's worse, as you know, for young boys. It's unsustainable. You know, I'm not sure the folks at the CDC or NIH or HHS understand that. I mean, it's a personal price for children and the families that are affected, the financial price for the families and society as a whole. That's just starters.
That is, and you've captured the issue just so perfectly. And we do, you know, when Representative Weldon retired, you basically have picked up that torch from him, and we do appreciate it so much. Now, the November 2012 Government Reform Committee hearing, it was called the Federal Response to the Autism Epidemic. What was your impression? I mean, you had some, you know, not only did you listen to the different testimonies and you listened to the entire and were there for the entire hearing, but you also had some very direct questions for Dr. Colleen Boyle, who's the head of the National Center for Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities at the CDC.
Well, I don't like it when anybody's evasive, and I'm sure you don't, nor most of your listeners. I mean, you know, just be straightforward and honest. You know, don't be evasive. Dr. Boyle was intentionally evasive. I asked her a very direct question. You know, have you done a study comparing autism rates in vaccinated versus unvaccinated children? She started telling us about everything that she'd done in order to avoid answering that question. I mean, it's like I asked her what time it was, and she tried to take up all my time describing how a clock works, you know. And after she wasted 3 minutes, I cut her off, and I demanded that she answer the question. And then, only then, did she admit that the federal government has never done that very simple, fundamental, basic study. You can do that retroactively, as you know, and most of the people listening know. Every vaccine study the CDC does is retroactive, and they parade them around as being valid. So it's shocking to know that for some reason, suddenly, they say if they do a retroactive study that it's looking at past data that already exists. They say that study would not be valid. And that's just outrageous, to say the very least.
I was sitting there in the front row, and I was cheering you on. You know, I tried not to be audible, but in my mind, I was doing the wave for you because we so much appreciated, and it was so evident in that hearing that Dr. Boyle was being evasive. And I love your analogy about the clock. Now, later on, Dr. Boyle, it took her about 4 months, but you gave her some written questions that you wanted her to answer. And in April 2013, then Dr. Boyle and the CDC came up with these written answers. Is it okay if we talk about those?
Yeah, you know, and I mean, I know we have an autism epidemic. You know it. She knows it. She knows we know it. But for some reason, they refuse to acknowledge it, you know, publicly. And as soon as the public health officials acknowledge that we have an epidemic, then maybe we can see them bring the full force of research to the table. Right now, for whatever reason, intentionally or unintentionally, they're in denial, if it's my opinion.
I couldn't agree more, absolutely. And in Dr. Boyle's written testimony, she called autism an important public health concern, but she refused to call the situation an epidemic. And when she came out specifically and this last week, and referred to the autism statistics as 1 in 68, and you said correctly that it affects more boys. It's about 1 in 42 boys, based on the CDC's numbers. She again refused to call this an epidemic, which is just unimaginable. Even the American Academy of Pediatrics has called this an epidemic, and we've got this huge nationwide problem that the CDC refuses to address.
Yeah, she says, her answer to everything was that, well, if we just diagnose better, we spot it better. In other words, if it wasn't for the bureaucrats having some special diagnosis, 90% of the people with autism wouldn't know it, neither would their parents.
I just contend that that's not true. We just don't see these children, and I don't see that in the 1960s and 1970s, where supposedly if we had better diagnosis, then we had 1 in 68 then as well. I don't see that doctors had any trouble diagnosing a child that had severe language delays or came in and they were flapping their arms because they were trying to stimulate their vestibular system. I can't imagine that. And
neither can I. I don't think anybody that's intellectually honest with this issue can even begin to fathom that lame excuse that she uses.
Yeah, it makes no sense. There have been several peer-reviewed studies that have shown that the autism epidemic is real, that in terms of more diagnosis or greater level of awareness, that may account for about 10% of the increase in autism cases, but then we have 90% of the cases that the CDC just basically buries their head and says, we're just going to ignore you.
Yeah, it adds insult to injury.
Yes, yes. Now, you referred to Dr. Paul Thorson, and Dr. Paul Thorson was up until 2010 a CDC affiliate from Denmark, and he was indicted in Atlanta federal court on April 13, 2011 on 13 counts of wire fraud and on 9 counts of money laundering. Okay, and during your questioning, you referred to Dr. Thorson as a scumbag, and
that's because I couldn't use the description of an unmentionable body part in public.
Well, I appreciate that. Okay, but now, interestingly, Colleen Boyle indicated that Thorson had only participated in one CDC-funded paper. In truth, he's collaborated, and he collaborated up until 2013 on 36 papers. Now, what does that say about Dr. Boyle's testimony?
Well, I called it what it was at that time. I think she misled the committee to the Congress about this crook, Thorson, and his involvement. If you read through the emails, learn about the meetings and the financial arrangements this crook had with the CDC, it will make you absolutely sick to your stomach. This was no casual researcher way down the line. This was the CDC's key man in Denmark. He was closely tied to the CDC's top vaccine safety researchers. You know, as I see it, the CDC's view seems to have been as long as Thorson was cooking the books to produce the results they wanted. They didn't care whether the studies were valid or how much money was being siphoned off the top. They just obviously did not bother to look. It's like the Securities and Exchange Commission and Bernie Madoff. But it's worse, because we're talking about someone who basically stole money that was supposed to be used to improve the health and safety of our most vulnerable in our society, in our young babies.
Right, right. And I like your analogy with Bernie Madoff. It just seems like the CDC really could have cared less. I mean, they got the result out of Dr. Thorson that they wanted. They were able to say that the thimerosal-containing vaccines did not have an effect in Denmark, neither did the MMR vaccine, and so therefore he was given carte blanche. Now, Boyle, in her written response, she said later that the CDC actually refused to investigate the science behind the studies in which Thorson co-authored. In other words, they weren't going to look at it. They still said that these were valid studies, despite the fact that Thorson, who had been indicted in Atlanta court, despite the fact that he had co-authored these studies. Do you feel that that's appropriate?
Of course not. Again, I hate to just use, you know, the Securities and Exchange Commission and Bernie Madoff as an example, but I mean, I see these, you know, glaring parallels. You know, that guy Markopoulos went to the Securities and Exchange Commission 10 years before Madoff bilked people out of $70 billion. And he gave him a file that any prosecutor could pick up and run with. And for 10 years, the Securities and Exchange Commission and over 50 complicit employees ignored Bernard Madoff. And the CDC did the same with Thorson.
And it's interesting. I just recently found out that one of CDC's top scientists regarding autism recently, her name's Dr. Diana Shandell, she recently quit the CDC and strangely emigrated to Denmark, and she is now working directly with Thorson. Thorson's a known fugitive. He's a fugitive. If you look at the DHHS Office of the Inspector General, the top 10 fugitives in the United States, Thorson is on that list. And now we have a CDC employee who has quit the CDC and is now working and doing autism research with this fugitive. She emigrated to Denmark. I mean, and it just seems like the CDC just ignores this issue entirely.
You know, you can't say it any more simply than that.
Right, right. Now, you mentioned earlier that Boyle said that the CDC had never looked at the health outcomes of vaccinated versus unvaccinated populations. And this is, you know, it's ludicrous. The CDC, in their written response to your question, said, it would be unethical to do a certain study because you would have to pick individuals who were blinded and then would be refused vaccination. Now, this is what they described as what's called a prospective study, and it's odd because the CDC never does prospective studies like this. They only do what are called retrospective or look-back studies. Now, could you describe how this played out and you know, what you are doing actually to address this?
Well, first of all, you know, that was just some red meat they threw out there for the beginners, to people who do all the blogging and shredding anybody who dares question the unaccountable bureaucrats. You know, like it was suggested all over the blog sphere that evil Bill Posey literally wanted the government to withhold vaccinations from children so they could study them. And now, you know, that's a bold-faced lie, and I know it's a bold-faced lie, but that's how, through their little media network, they twist the truth, you know, to disparage, to malign, to vilify, to denigrate anybody who wants any kind of accountability in this crazy house. How did it affect me? It just encourages me more. It makes me even more determined. I've introduced a bipartisan bill. It's House Resolution 1757. We call it quite simply what it is, the Vaccine Safety Study Act. And that would require a vaccinated versus non-vaccinated study. It's just Congresswoman Maloney and me right now. We need more co-sponsors, and I hope everyone listening to this program today needs to call their member of Congress and ask them to add their name as a co-sponsor to the bill. And I understand in the autism community there's a little bit of a fracture. There's some people that think, you know, Mercury bears a large part of the responsibility for what we have here, and there's others who think that it bears no part of the responsibility. And I'm kind of in the middle of that, you know, quite frankly. I mean, I think it has responsibility, but I think the spectrum is so large that other things can play into it, too. And I'd like to know, you know, just how much the vaccinations do play into it. And I think everyone would like to know that. And when we know that, then that part is off the table. Then we can focus on other remedies, you know. But they just don't want to do it. And I'm hoping that we can compel them to do it with this legislation. And again, I urge anyone that has any interest in this thing, no matter what side of that coin that you're on right now, if you would get proactive and we could force this issue to have the state, then that is off the table. Then everything else we will be moving forward to completely united.
Correct. I couldn't have said it better. And you and I have talked directly about this particular bill. And one of the things that you've assured is that there would be accountability. There would be accountability and direct oversight of the government. If the Department of Health and Human Services does this study, that it would be done in such a way that it would be a, we wouldn't have the dubious CDC tobacco science statistics. So I do appreciate that. Now, how do you feel about this raises the whole issue of the overall state of vaccine safety and safety in the United States, and the CDC, as far as I can see, they can't really be trusted regarding investigating vaccine safety and vaccine adverse events, and it seems that there's a huge conflict of interest. The CDC buys $4 billion worth of vaccines from the vaccine manufacturers, and then they distribute it to the rest of the country. How can we trust them, and can we trust them to look at any type of vaccine safety issue?
Well, I think the CDC should be investigated. Should the vaccine safety office even be at the CDC? I'm inclined to think no. Today they're the arresting police officer, the judge, and the jury. We know how that's going to come out every time, don't we? The arresting officer is going to be right 100% of the time when he controls the judge and the jury. The incestuous relationship between the public health community, the vaccine makers, and government officials should not be allowed to continue. I mean, too many top CDC personnel go to work for the vaccine makers when they leave. That's a revolving door that creates a serious conflict of interest and perverse incentives that compromise integrity. If you read Jack Abramoff, one of the most infamous lobbyists who recently got out of prison and wrote a book on how he bought all the congressional offices, he went around and said, hey, to every staffer that he thought was important to him, hey, look, when you get tired of working for a Congressman X, Y, or Z, you give me a call, I'll triple your salary. And he said he never even had to worry about contacting the offices to see what's going on anymore, that all those prospective staffers who, expected to work for him at triple their salary someday would call him. And that's kind of the scenario you see with the incestuous relationship that appears that we have with the CDC and so much of the RX industry. I filed legislation to close the revolving door also in Congress, that's saying, okay, if you want to go become a lobbyist, then you give up all your federal benefits. You give up your federal retirement. You give up your federal insurance and all that. When you want to get on the other side of the board, then you do that. And maybe we should just have a policy of the same thing. If you want to leave the CDC or any regulatory agency in the federal government, if you leave and you want to go to work for the people you regulate, then you give up all the federal benefits that you've accrued to that point.
Wow, incredible. You are an American hero. And I think of the former CDC director, Dr. Julie Gerberding, who in 2009 became the director of the vaccine division of Merck. Okay, she went directly into that position. I think she was out of the CDC for an obligatory 12 months. And we see that revolving door with Thomas Verstraeten, Frank DiStefano, and others, Robert Davis, who have been in the CDC, and then they get lucrative jobs with vaccine manufacturers, and it's just, how can they regulate? It just makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah, and in fairness, that they're valuable to the industry because of the information that they have acquired while they were working there. I mean, that doesn't mean the industry, prima facie evidence that the industry is corrupt by hiring in them. But they got all that while they were supposedly regulating the industry and serving the taxpayers. And the role reverses, once they cross that threshold.
Right, right, and it's that role reversal. If somebody is in a regulatory position and they realize that, you know, at the end of the rainbow there's this pot of gold in terms of a lucrative pharmaceutical position, then they're truly conflicted. They have a built-in conflict of interest, because they're basically looking at this particular point in time, perhaps courting their future employers.
Yeah, and that's one of the big problems we have in this country now. You know, most congressional staff, you know, look at that as the ultimate payday.
Wow, Congressman, I've been listening in the wing, and I feel compelled to say that you've spoken here today very courageously, forthrightly, and eloquently, and I just really want to thank you.
Well, I appreciate what y'all do, that there's advocates out there, that, you know, everybody doesn't view the solution to this dilemma, to this epidemic, is to crawl underneath the table, put your thumb in your mouth, get in a fetal position, and hope that somebody else does it, you know, that will take up the reins and run with the ball. And y'all are running with the ball, and my hat's off to you, and you can count on me to help any way I can.
Thank you so much, Congressman Posey.
You're welcome.
And to our listeners, Dr. Hooker and I will be right back after this brief break at the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Every child with autism deserves a voice, but for many, using words and language to express themselves is one of the most difficult parts of their day. Fast Forward is an online program that was developed by leading neuroscientists to help these children find their voice. Fast Forward targets the foundational language and processing skills your child needs to become a successful communicator and proficient reader. Get started with Fast Forward at home today. Visit brainprolearning.com or call 855-308-1362 to learn more.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Save on your prescriptions with the RX Savings Plus Drug Discount Card offered by Voice America. It is not insurance, and discounts are only available from participating pharmacies. But 9 out of 10 pharmacies participate nationwide. Start saving today. Print your free card online at voiceamerica.rxsavingsplus.com or text the word TALK RADIO to 96362.
Welcome back to Autism One, a conversation of hope with Terry Aranga. If you have a question or comment, call us toll-free at 866-472-5792. Now back to the program. Here's Terry.
This is Terry Aranga here with Dr. Brian Hooker again. Brian Hooker is an associate professor of biology at Simpson University, specializing in chemistry and biology. Dr. Hooker is also a senior process consultant working closely on process design for the environment restoration industry, and his design efforts focus on industrial biotechnology and chemical engineering principles. Dr. Hooker received his doctorate in biochemical engineering. And Dr. Hooker, I welcome you back to this segment of this special Autism Awareness Month program here on Voice America. And thank you for a great interview with Congressman Bill Posey.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. It's a privilege to be on your show, and I think that it's imperative that shows like yours get as much coverage as possible, especially when we look at, you know, the current rates of autism at 1 at 68. That's just astronomical.
Yes, it's an astounding number of children affected. Well, Dr. Hooker, you've spent a significant amount of time uncovering malfeasance in the CDC, specifically regarding vaccines and autism. Have you looked at the science behind this relationship? Why do you believe that the CDC studies do not pass muster?
Well, I've done, you know, I've focused so many years on just uncovering, you know, malfeasance, going through things like old reports and email traffics and drafts of studies and things like that. But just recently, within the past year or so, I've been able to start to look at and reanalyze some of the CDC studies on vaccines and autism, among other neurodevelopmental disorders. And I'm seeing, you know, it's been wonderful in a way, because rather than looking at just pure malfeasance, I'm actually able to look at the science and start with the same raw data that the CDC started with. I've actually requested and in some cases received some of the original data sets. Of course, all the patient names are taken out and all the identifiers are taken out. So it's just, you know, essentially data sets showing things like exposure to thimerosal, both prenatal and postnatal, different neurological diagnoses, timing of different vaccines, whether vaccines were taken on time, and so forth. And then I've been able to go back and redesign the studies the way that I feel in a method that is most appropriate in order to actually see relationships, not cover up relationships, but actually see, do relationships exist between different vaccines and the vaccine schedule in autism spectrum disorders?
All right, so you've mentioned thimerosal, you've mentioned prenatal and infant vaccines. Did you see a connection there? What are the critical relationships that appear in your results?
Well, one of the things that really troubled me, I was able to get some of the earliest versions of the CDC's PRICE study. And just to give you some background, the CDC published the PRICE study in pediatrics in 2010. It was published after it was rejected by the Journal of the American Medical Association, as well as the New England Journal of Medicine. It was finally published in pediatrics. And I had some grave concerns about that paper, because when you look at the background information and the background data, you actually see that they saw that when women received thimerosal maternally when they were pregnant, that would be via the flu shot or via Rho IgG antibodies for Rh factor disease, which at that time contained thimerosal. The women that received thimerosal by either of those injections were about 8 times more likely to have a child regress in autism spectrum disorder, and that result never saw the light of day. So I was anxious to go back and look at the information. And not only do relationships exist between prenatal thimerosal exposure and autism, but I saw very interestingly that thimerosal exposure, especially in the first month of life, and we have millions of children who have received the birth Hep B shot or received the hepatitis B shot within the first month of life. My own son got his hepatitis B shot, his first one, which contained 12.5 micrograms of mercury at 2 weeks of life. And there's a significant population that got this vaccine and got it very, very early and also got a bolus of thimerosal at the same time. And I see across the board that these individuals were much more likely to receive a diagnosis of autism, autism spectrum disorder, or regressive autism spectrum disorder, just basically across the board. And the CDC covered up that relationship. They used what I felt were dubious statistical methods, and they actually obviated that and said quite the opposite, that thimerosal was somehow protecting children from getting autism.
You know, when you're speaking, Dr. Hooker, it actually reminds me of something that I remember from the Simpsonwood transcripts. These were clandestine meetings held in Georgia in the year 2000, I believe, June 2000. Am I on track here?
That's correct, June 2000.
Does this remind you of anything that was said there?
Oh yes, what Thomas Verstraeten said, and he published along with his co-investigators the Verstraeten study in 2003. But what he said was that the effect was all in the first month of life, and that he was seeing a statistically significant, very strong effect. His original study, which was done in 1999, showed that infants that received high levels of thimerosal in their vaccines when they were within the first month of life were 7.6 times more likely to get autism. And in some ways that he did the study, the risk ratio, or what we call relative risk, went up to 11. So that meant that children that received that thimerosal, that received that hepatitis B shot, were 11 more times more likely than those that didn't receive thimerosal in their first month of life. So this is, you know, this is nothing new. Now the CDC, you know, this was recently uncovered in some information that I got via congressional request back in August 2013. But now we're seeing that that's consistent. We have another publication. We have another set of data that says that the first month of life is extremely important. And of course, we've had millions of children that were exposed to thimerosal that early. Now, the other thing that I should mention is Verstraeten didn't look at prenatal effects. Okay, so we don't know from his particular information if there was also a prenatal effect, but we do know, Terry, as you pointed out, that in Simpson, when he said, look, the effect appears to be all in the first month of life.
And that was the Simpsonwood meeting in Norcross, Georgia in 2000 that we were referring to. And I think I remember from, you know, other discussion that there are critical and very sensitive, very vulnerable neurodevelopmental windows or very early in life postnatally and also prenatally. And so it just seems... It just does not make sense to, you know, they say that they took thimerosal out of shots, but then, you know, and you can address whether that was even true or not, in what amount, and for when they said it, when they said they did these things, but then to not recommend, for the CDC to not recommend against pregnant women getting mercury in their flu shots, it's just horrible.
It makes no sense. We tell women who are pregnant to avoid other exposures to mercury. We tell them not to eat tuna fish. We tell them in some respects, some obstetricians have said, hey, just don't eat fish in general because of the mercury exposure. But yet we go ahead and we inject them in any trimester of pregnancy. We inject them with 25 micrograms of mercury. And there have been studies, there have been rabbit studies that basically show that when you do that with thimerosal, it selectively partitions to the placenta and the bulk of it goes to the developing fetus. And it just, you know, how can the CDC, you know, it's unconscionable that the CDC would recommend that women receive thimerosal-containing flu shots. And over 50%, it's probably more like 70% of the flu shots that pregnant women receive in the United States contain thimerosal. And over 50% of pregnant women, the uptake of the flu shot in pregnant women is about 50% as well. So we have a significant portion of our population that, you know, when they're unborn, are being exposed to 25 micrograms of mercury. That is just not a good start.
Right. So they say that they've got mercury out of some childhood shots, but then these fetuses, these very tiny children, are being given mercury at a very critical neurodevelopmental, very sensitive time. And that really skews results, I would think, from a layman's perspective. That really skews results, and then they can just go and say, oh, look, they were born with it, or, oh, look, it must be genetic. What do you think about that?
I think that it is it's dubious at best, but it is, you know, we are amidst the biggest iatrogenic disaster in history. I mean, this is a catastrophe beyond belief. I think, you know, if you had tried to invent something like this in a fictional, you know, in some type of fictional world, you couldn't really come up with anything worse than this. And studies have shown, I mean, there are plenty of studies that show the effects of thimerosal on developing neurological tissues. What happens is that the thimerosal will basically strip the protein tubulin that is in what are called the axons, and axons are responsible for what's called long-range connectivity in the brain. I mean, we need long-range connectivity to develop things like speech and language, to be able to read and write. And lo and behold, there is, when thimerosal is tested on this neurological tissue, the long-range connectivity goes away, the axons are short and stubby, and lo and behold, what you also see in autism is an extremely limited amount of long-range connectivity. These kids, you know, just like the thimerosal-exposed neurons, they have short, stubby axons, and they're overconnected in what's called the short range, but their opportunity to develop things like speech and language, to be able to develop reading and writing and cognitive skills are basically stolen away from them before they're even born.
All right, so this is biologically plausible that thimerosal can do this to brain tissue. It's clinically realistic in that we see the symptoms borne out in real children, so it's biologically plausible. It's been shown, like on the Calgary video, so this can be done in, what is that called, in vivo?
In vitro and tissue culture, yes.
And it's clinically realistic, biologically plausible, realistic in vitro. It's been shown clinically realistic. And if I may draw a picture for our listeners, Brian, is this like you have a wire in your house where you're trying to plug in an appliance or plug in your telephone and you're taking the plastic stuff that covers that wire and just stripping it back? Is that what's happening to cells in the brain in tiny children when they're exposed to thimerosal?
I think that's a very good analogy. You're taking the insulation off the wire. Once you take the insulation off the wire, then you get short circuits. Okay, and if that wire touches anything metal, then you will create a short circuit, and the appliance, which, you know, may be linked to 100 feet of copper wire from the power source coming into the house from the power grid. That particular wire then no longer operates. Okay, so you don't have a connection between your waffle iron and the power grid. Okay, because you've stripped off the insulation, and now that particular wire short circuits.
And we know that some children with autism, with the diagnostic label of autism, in fact had antibodies to myelin basic protein. In their objective laboratory analyses, and myelin is the insulation that is surrounding those wires in the brain. Is that true?
That is true. And so what's happened is that the myelin basic protein has been essentially ejected from these neurons. It ends up in areas where you would not expect myelin basic protein, and the body raises up an immune response because it's seeing the wrong thing at the wrong time. So it starts to attack the myelin sheath. Now we have thimerosal attacking the myelin sheath, and then we have anti-myelin antibodies that are, you know, in concert attacking the myelin sheath. So you just don't see long-range connectivity in children that get an autism diagnosis.
These people who allowed our children to be deluged with thimerosal and set up this autoimmune response allowed our children's brains to eat themselves. Our children's brains eating themselves. That is an analogy.
That's correct. That, you know, it's when you have a neurological autoimmune response, the brain is attacking itself.
Well, Brian, we've been talking about thimerosal and we've been talking about autism. What other disorders could be related to thimerosal exposure? Have you investigated that?
Well, I'm glad to talk about that. The CDC has done a number of different studies where they've looked at quote unquote neurotypical children to see if there are any type of developmental delays or developmental maladies that have come up due to thimerosal exposure. And what they did was they came up with what's called a regression statistic. They actually looked at, you know, and if you did this graphically, if you will, you plot the number of children that have a particular developmental malady against their thimerosal exposure, and they're seeing statistically significant relationships. Now, the CDC, and they published their main study, was Thompson et al. That came out in 2007 in the New England Journal of Medicine, and the only thing that they said was statistically significant was that if males were exposed to higher levels of thimerosal within the first 7 months of life, then they were about twice as likely to develop motor tics and phonic tics. And the CDC basically dismissed away the result. And, you know, as if this was not a debilitating neurological condition. And I'm sorry, you know, people that have Tourette's syndrome, you know, that suffer with tics, with motor tics and phonic tics, children that have tics, I mean, they suffer. This is not something that we want the boys in the United States to suffer with and be twice as likely just for the sake of getting thimerosal in their infant vaccines, okay? A compound that could be easily removed. And so we've had children now, you know, now we give thimerosal-containing flu shots to children at 6 months of life. It's actually 12.5 micrograms of mercury that's given at 6 months of life. And so we're back in the same boat. The CDC can't back out and say, oh, we removed thimerosal from vaccines. That is a fallacy. It's not true. And so we're putting our children on the front lines and basically exposing them to this neurotoxin. Now, that's what the CDC admitted. They admitted that boys were more likely to get motor tics and phonic tics, and this was all boys together. They didn't look at any particular subset of the population. They didn't divide it down based on race or anything like that. But when I reanalyze the information, and I've actually confirmed this in background CDC studies, I see a myriad of effects on speech and language, specifically in boys, some actually going into females as well. And I also see that children that were exposed to high levels of thimerosal within the first month of life, and in some cases in the first 7 months of life, in general scored lower on IQ scores. So we're basically, we're giving our children mercury, and their IQs are becoming lower, and we're dumbing down America.
Right. So if a child isn't affected with the diagnostic label of autism, they may have one of other disorders. College entrance exams have requirements have had to be lowered. The SAT has changed. The military is now looking for a few good women, maybe because there aren't a few good men left anymore. Brian, the CDC's papers indicate that there's no evidence of harm from thimerosal-containing vaccines. Is that the case? So why would there be a difference between your results and theirs?
Well, the CDC does a lot of things in order to dilute out the effect of the relationship. Now, when you design a good epidemiology study, you want to have maximum variability of exposure in both your cases and your controls. You want to make sure that those individuals received, you know, that you basically cover the entire range of exposures, including children that were not exposed to thimerosal at all the way up to the children that got maximum levels of thimerosal in both prenatal and postnatal exposure. So you want to make sure that you have a good cross-section. Once you narrow that, and what the CDC does is they use a method called stratification, and they only compare males against males. They won't compare males against females, which in some respects is fine, but more insidiously, they will only compare those individuals that were born within the same year and that were in the same HMO. Okay, and what that does is it means that, you know, these HMOs will buy their vaccines from the CDC in bulk. Okay, the CDC itself buys about $4 billion worth of vaccines per year, and then the HMOs in turn purchase those from the CDC. And they buy them in bulk. So within the HMO, essentially all of the individuals, all the boys and girls that are receiving their infant vaccines are getting the same exposure of thimerosal. And you can't do a study like that. Okay, let's imagine that I was going to do a study, and this is kind of a landmark study on this phenomenon, statistical error called overmatching. Let's say that I want to look at the effect of cancer in folks that were exposed to ionizing radiation in a nuclear power plant. Okay, well, if I pick my cases and my controls, those that were unaffected, that didn't get cancer, from the same nuclear power plant, and they all got the same dose of nuclear radiation, then that would be a null study. I mean, I couldn't do it. My control group, I have to have individuals that were never exposed to ionizing radiation in order to do that cancer study. And in the same respect, the CDC is not doing that. They're not looking at individuals that were never exposed to thimerosal. They're not looking at an accurate range of thimerosal concentrations. And so they're getting these statistically dubious results, and they're coming back and they're saying there's no effect. There is absolutely no relationship between thimerosal containing vaccines and neurological issues, including autism, including speech and language delay. But they are basically, they're using these dubious statistical methods. They cut out all variability. Robert Hitlin and Kathy DeSoto out of University of Northern Iowa have done a great review on this, and consistently they will use these dubious techniques and in some cases outright just cherry pick and hide data. You know, they pick the points that they want to report and they hide the points that they don't want to report. And so we have this huge mess.
Very astute analysis, Dr. Hooker. Well, in the time remaining, is thimerosal the only problem regarding vaccines and autism? Have you looked at the relationship between any other particular vaccine and autism?
Yeah, I think that, you know, to say that thimerosal is the only problem with the current vaccination schedule is really an understatement. The vaccine schedule has not been studied. Okay, Colleen Boyle admitted it in the November 2002 Oversight and Government Reform hearing on autism. She admitted that the CDC has never looked at vaccinated versus unvaccinated cohorts. That they just flat out had not done that. Now, I was able to get some background information on the timing of the MMR vaccine. And the CDC came out with a study by DeStefano in 2004, and they said, hey, you know, you can receive the MMR vaccine at any point in time, you know, if you receive it early, if you receive it on time, if you receive it late, there's absolutely no relationship between the timing of the MMR vaccine and autism. Okay. And so what I did is I went and I looked at the raw data. I reanalyzed the statistics. I used essentially the same methods that the CDC did, but I used a larger cohort set. I had more individuals in my particular cohort than they did. They excluded individuals merely because if an individual could not produce a birth certificate, then they were excluded from the study. So I decided to include everybody, regardless of whether they had a birth certificate or not. I saw that there was no relationship between MMR status and whether an individual could produce a birth certificate, so I included what's called the entire cohort. And I saw a strong relationship between MMR timing and autism in boys. And I winnowed down a little bit further, and I actually looked at African-American males, and what I found was the entirety of the MMR effect was within African-American males. So if you look at African-American males that received their MMR vaccine after 3 years of life versus those that received their MMR vaccine on time or, you know, essentially before 3 years of life, those that received their MMR vaccine on time were 3.5 times, not percent, but times, more likely to receive an autism diagnosis than those individuals that delayed the MMR vaccine. And that effect was exclusively in African-American boys.
Well, this is fascinating information, Dr. Hooker. And listeners can talk to you more about this at the Autism One 2014 conference in May. Please visit www.autismone.org. Thank you very much, Dr. Hooker, for your steadfast, excellent, and intelligent work for children and families everywhere.
Thank you, Terry. I'm really looking forward to seeing you and Ed at the conference and everybody, and I recommend if you're on
the heart is a blue, shoots up through the stony ground, there's no room.
Thank you for listening to the Positively Healthy Show on KCNR 1416 Shasta Radio. Go to KCNR1460.com to chat with us or give us a call at 605-4567.
With SRN News, I'm Bob Agnew in Washington. Pro-Russia insurgents in eastern Ukraine have released 7 military observers and 5 Ukrainian assistants who had been held for more than a week. Alex Schneider is head of the European military observers held by those insurgents.
This is my impression that enormous effort has been taken. This is unforgettable for us. Never ever I will forget that.
Meanwhile, the group's deputy chief Mark Etherington says despite a deteriorating situation in eastern Ukraine, the group is expanding its work there.
We believe that the requirement for dialogue is as strong as ever. The mission is in fact expanding its activities. We're at about 150 monitors on the ground now, and we'll go up to 500 within the next couple of months.
The observers from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe were seized on April 25th. Health officials yesterday confirmed the first case of an American infected